continue through this Sunday school time. And last week, we just got started. We get started a little bit late because of the weather, but people coming in. But we started off in James chapter 4. And we're looking at a topic that is primarily in James 4, but we're going to spend some time also in James chapter 1 as we deal with it. What is the topic? It's dealing with desire. Desire. And just to review a few of the things that we considered from last week, set the tone for today. When we're talking about this term, it's in some versions of the Bible, it's lust. King James Version translates it as lust, which today has almost a negative connotation, well, a negative connotation in every situation, which is like the word trial or temptation. The word trial or temptation was neutral, and so we talked about a temptation, it didn't necessarily mean what we think of today, and so the context had to tell you whether it was a good thing or a bad thing. Well, when it comes to this term desire, which is translated in New King James, which is probably the better way to translate it, once again, it's a neutral term. The term could be a desire for what is good or a desire for what is bad. So it could be a strong desire to please God, or it could be lust. And the context is going to tell you that. So we took a look at some examples. There were a number of examples of Christ and the apostles all talking about, I strongly desire to eat this feast with you. Before I go to Jerusalem, I strongly desire to eat the Passover with you. You know, the Lord did not have an inordinate lust for that. He had a strong desire to do something that was right and good and true. Well, here we're looking at this term now as it's being used in our lives to be examined as desires for sin. We'll just take one half of this. So there could be good desires. That's what we already talked about. But now we're going to talk about how is this when this term is used to talk about sin, you know, in our lives? The desire, the temptation, the desire, the lust for things that are not good. We did some background study through here, and what we've already identified is the fact that when it comes to desires for sin, there are two sources that we should know. And one source are just the innate drives of our body. Hunger, if it's directed in the wrong way, can become sin. Thirst, directed in the wrong way, can become sin. Just a while back, there was a discussion from Jacob's life of Esau and his desire for some lentil soup when he came back from hunting. You know, there was a desire for food. Is the desire for food bad? No. That he placed it ahead of all the blessings of God in his life and was willing to exchange them? Yes. So bodily desires can be fulfilled in such a way that they become sinful. Then we went on, we talked about those that we call mind-implanted desires. So you have innate bodily desires, you have mind-implanted desires. Those are things that we attune our minds to think are good or bad. And we all do this. We all train ourselves to think of if something is good or noble or beautiful. In fact, in a classical structure of education, that was the earliest ages. You know, what are the things that you're teaching, you know, the youngest children to do? You're not really helping them be great discerners of things at that time. The brain doesn't really work so much that way. But what you do teach them is that there's some things that are bad. And there's some things that are good. There's some things that are noble. There's some things that are corrupt. And so you spend time teaching children to do that. That's the basis upon which then they learn to make critical judgments. Well, in the same way, you can train a mind to consider that what is evil is good. In fact, I would not have to go far to just take discussions that are going on in our public school system and go, we're teaching children that good is evil and evil is good in a number of areas. Or in entertainment industry, evil, good. Good's sometimes harder to find. And just go through life. It's in area after area. Churches. Mary just handed me an article about the bishops in the Roman Church, the Catholics that are pushing to open up the priesthood to women, to recognize and celebrate gay marriage, to, you know, etc. And That's happening in Protestant denominations as well. Just happened to me, the Catholics happened to be in the paper this week. So to teach people to value what is corrupt, evil, or ugly is what we can do in our society with young people and in our own minds. But even as we're as adults, we're not immune to that. And our idea of what is desirable can change. Isn't that what Paul tells us in Romans chapter 1? That sin is it is in the nature, as the truth of God is suppressed, we substitute a lie for what is true, and pretty soon we become people who teach what is evil as good, and good is evil, which is an ultimate part of reprobation. And so that becomes a part of life that most people come to faith. This is a part of your life. Two kinds of desires that are there. Now, as we learned about those desires, epithymia is the term that's used here. This is a very strong desire, neutral term, but the cravings that come from the way that we train that desire gives us problems. We ended up by talking about those cravings, and the thrust of what James is telling us is that it's the craving that's the problem, not the object. You know, so often we want to toss the responsibility for sin off on something that's been presented to us. It's in front of us. And the thrust here is that our response to that is because of what's inside. So the same temptation that might be an extremely difficult temptation for someone to overcome. You might walk by and it's just repulsive to you. You have no desire. It has no hook in you to pull on. And that's the thrust of what we're going to see today as we go on and talk about how does sin really get around setting its hooks in us? How is this craving realized? So let's continue off at this point, and we'll just go to the first one. What happens when we cave into a craving? I mean, is it just that this craving is different? This is where, as we, in one way or another, whether we're caving in mentally to, you know, to sort of titillate ourselves with the idea of the sin, and when I use those terms, it may go in certain directions in your mind. You could titillate yourself with the dessert that you're planning to have, which could become all-encompassing. I notice I have fun with it every once in a while, you can tell, and I talk about chocolate. And I've actually, the first time I did that, I had some ladies in the church come and talk to me and say, stop talking about chocolate. You know, it's like, I thought I was picking something neutral that nobody would, you know, really have a problem with. I'm like, ooh, I guess not. So you're looking at this and we're saying, all right, you've got this issue that's here, and you inwardly assent to it, to this wrong desire. You can convince yourself that this is something that should be indulged in. You can convince yourself at the very moment, say, I'm going to just allow myself to think about it. You know, I mean, I know I'm not going to do it. What can I pick that's neutral, right? I mean, because there's just about everything. I'm going to find out. I'm going to pick bread, and somebody else is going to come and get me, and then, you know, and I'll pick whatever. But, you know, whatever it is, you know, you can think about something. You can say, you know what? I'm not doing it. I can just think about it. And as I think about it and I enjoy it in my mind, well, I'm innocent. No, you're training your brain to give into and to respond to sin. And in some sense, that inward response is going to end up having a bodily response as well. For example, some people indulge in murderous hate. Just all sorts of harmful things happening to their enemy. I mean, that's what they daydream about. And the Proverbs tells us not to do that. Proverbs 24:17 says, don't rejoice when your enemy falls, or let your heart be glad when he stumbles. By the way, it's just about the same thing in 1 Corinthians 13. This is the sort of thing that Jesus had in view when he spoke about the man who looks after a woman in order to lust after her. This isn't a saying like, oops, something walked in front of my face. It's like saying, you're looking with the intention of titillating yourself, of dwelling on it, of enjoying it, of storing it away for use later, of, and if you do that, you will certainly be stimulating your body as well. And that natural response, again, it's both brain and body, and both are sinful. Indulging, delighting in what God forbids is the picture that we have been seeing here in James. Our goal is to cut that off. Indulging and delighting in what God forbids, and eventually, one way or another, your body begins to participate. Whether you're picturing this delicious dark chocolate, or you're in your mind, you're calling up the smell of fresh baked bread, or you're looking at pictures of scantily clothed women, or you're thinking about whatever it is you're going to kind of a profit you're going to make on a deal you're working on. At a certain point, your body begins to feel and respond, to be aroused by those thoughts. So it's not merely a matter of contemplating a possibility, but it really becomes a matter of both the body and the mind participating. You know, you think about that food item all along, and pretty soon you're going to get hungry. That's a bodily response. You're liable to start salivating a little bit. You know, just like, oh my. Just walk in the bakery, and there it is. So the thrust is that even as we consent to things in our brain and dwell on them in our brain, that's where the problem begins to happen. It's with the consent and the dwelling on it. If you live in this world, you know that in this world is geared to tempt you with all sorts of things. Things that society would say are fine. You know, to be discontent with what you have, to need the newer car, or the newest car, or the newest phone, or whatever it might be. You know, we are living in a world where there's entire industry geared at, in fact, several of them, feeding our temptations and desires. And so James is talking to us about something that is absolutely essential in the day in which we live. And then here becomes the problem. The problem is that these desires become personalized in our lives. Now flip back if you want to for a minute. We're going to look at one verse from chapter 1. James chapter 1 verse 4. We'll drop out of chapter 4 for a minute and go to chapter 1 verse 4. I've been having fun all day with. We're looking at chapter 4 verse 1, then we're looking at chapter 1 verse 4, and then in Matthew we're going to look at. So just I'm going to tell you right now, the bulletin is wrong. It's Matthew chapter 21, not 12, and it's not the office's fault. I put it on the PowerPoint. I put it on the outline. I don't know what I was thinking. So, but I am right when I say I want you to look at chapter 1, verse 4 of James. Here are James' words. Each one is tempted when he is drawn away by his own desires. You have something similar to that written pretty much every translation. Each one is tempted when everyone is drawn away by his own desires. Did you mean? Okay, so I got the wrong verse again. 4:14. Did I tell you I'm having trouble with verses today? I'm writing things wrong all over. Okay, I'm going like, I got it written down here. Is that right? Yeah. It says 14 right here. I just read it and told you 4. That's me today. All right. So in verse 14, each one is tempted when he's drawn away by his own desires and enticed. Having said all that, probably the thing that will stick in your mind about that verse forever is that I can't read the text. But let me ask you to think about something else. The emphasis of this verse is this. Each one is tempted when he is drawn away by his own desires. By his own desires. In fact, it's emphatic. Idios, this word in this verse really should be emphatic. I mean, if it wasn't for the fact that the King James used italics to tell you where they're supplying words that aren't in the original, I would say this word should be in italics or underlined or in bold print, or at least in your own Bible, just underline the word own, because that's the thrust. Every one of us is tempted when we are drawn away by our own desires. And they're not the same. They're not the same. We create this pattern of temptation in our minds. We create these things, and they characterize who we are. The word means it's your own, it's individualized, it's an individual desire, Vincent in his book puts it, the peculiar lusts of his own. We get the first half of our word idiosyncrasy from this. This is our own desire. It's our own idiosyncrasy. It's our own pattern of temptation and sin. And they're all kind of a little different. Right? I mean, like, we're all sitting here in church. We're all dressed up, dressed to come to church. We're not all dressed the same way. Little differences along the way. And some of us have certain patterns, maybe in the way that we dress. It's like, okay, I don't look out and see a lot of three-piece black suits. That's just me here. That's not everybody. All right. Not that that's essential. My point is, it's a pattern. You can pretty well count. In fact, little children who see me at church, you know, in the middle of the week not wearing a black suit sometimes stop and for the first time and look back and go like, something's wrong here. I have noticed that, yes. I've actually scared some adults. They just say it. It comes out their mouth. You get used to a certain pattern. And your sin, your desires, lusts, combine to make a certain pattern that affects you. Everyone has the same innate desires, same bodily, right? Bodily desires. I mean, we all have hunger. We all get thirsty. You know, there's some bodily, you know, sex is part of that bodily pattern. It's a desire that's there. All those things are just quite part of our natural condition. And yet not all of us have those attuned in the same way. I remember teaching at a conference, and I felt so bad about it because I had used an illustration I often use about this kind of a temptation, about how some people are tempted for cheese. They love cheesecake. Let's go to the Cheesecake Factory. Let's get cheesecake. New York cheesecake is the best cheesecake. My wife makes a better cheesecake. You know, and I've had people offer like, hey, you want to get some cheesecake? Like, I hate cheesecake. It's not like I get sick on it. I could eat it. But to me, it's just like eating fluff. I don't know what, maybe there's a flavor in it you like. I really don't like it. So I use that illustration of, you know, these how our tastes are different and our temptations are acclimated differently. And then I walked out and the host was serving cheesecake for lunch. And while I'm eating, my plate keeps filling up with everybody putting cheesecake over on the table. But the average person, you might say people with a sane palate, I don't know, they love cheesecake. Cheesecake Factory didn't make a whole business out of people hating cheesecake. So it's the same thing with your temptations. There are some things that are appealing to you that would have no impact on someone sitting next to you whatsoever. Now, how do those, since we start off with in our body the same temptations, how does that become a problem? Well, our body has the same desires, but you can give in to temptations in an ungodly way, correct? What's probably the most obvious? I'll leave the food alone for a minute. We're all created as sexual beings. Are there wrong ways to fulfill sexual desire? Probably more than, you know, we can think of. Hopefully. So, I mean, hopefully that we can think of those. So they're just out there. They're all over. My counseling people coming in, telling me things that they're dealing with out of, when I get people from outside the church and whatever. I mean, it's just a plethora of stuff. So, what happens? You take a normal bodily desire and you begin to increasingly fill it with a wrong way to fulfill that desire, and pretty soon you have tuned your body even to respond to that sin. Maybe not even to respond as it should to the normal stimuli, but to that sin. So bodily desires, which may not be sinful in and of themselves, by the way that you think about them and train your mind to respond to them, they can become a sinful temptation. It's pretty personalized for you. You go to the next. What about the other category, that other source? Those mind-implanted desires. We look at the mind-implanted desires, and of course, those become uniquely different. You know, you can take a young child, and from the time they're young, you can teach them that they need to be the top of everything they do. You know, the only thing about sports is winning. The only thing about, you know, work is making money. The only thing you can train people to have mind-implanted desires that are not in keeping with Scripture at all. I mean, you know, people talk about the Puritan work ethic and they get it totally wrong. The Puritan work ethic and the people who held to it were very generous to those in need. They were very caring. They reached out and assisted people regularly. But they were concerned to honor God as they served their fellow man, both in work and in the rest of their life, because the Puritans had more ethics than just work. So we take a look at these desires, and both from starting from the body and starting from the brain, we can come up with our own unique set of individualized combination of desires. We all sin, but you might say we all have our own style of sinning. And we're all tempted, but we each have special temptations that we face. So a starting point for dealing with strong desires and temptation in our lives is to try and understand the patterns that affect us in our lives the most. So, you know, if you're struggling with sin and there's a desire that's you know you're giving into, it's good to just take a look at and go, so what's the pattern of sin in my life? What are the particular things that you put them together that I have acclimated my thoughts and my body and my responses to that I want to have in my life? Proverbs 14 talks about the heart knows its own bitterness that the stranger does not share. I would apply that to this as well. Each of us has to study our own desire pattern, become acquainted with it. Why? Not to dwell in it, but when you understand it, what do you want to do? How do we deal with desires? How do you deal with bodily desires? We talked about this last week, see? That's why this is an awkward review. Yes. Okay. Okay. And we're going to come to some of that in a minute. I'm going to suggest this. When it comes to bodily temptation, yeah, the actual part that's egregious, that's sinful, needs to be put off. What does that really mean? It means you need to control it. Because Jesus wasn't suggesting you actually go out and pluck out your eye or cut off your hand. There needs to be some control brought into that place. What about mind, desires of the mind from that source, those things that we've acclimated ourselves to? Those need to be cut off. So let me give you a typical example. I had one person I was supervising, and they were a 20-year-old-ish young man. And he was getting counselees from his church who were all his age. And so, like, every counselee he had was struggling with a porn problem. And so this comes up again and again and again and again. And I said, all right. Some of those guys are saying, like, I'm just praying that God would take away my desire for sex. Is that the approach? No. It's like, you know, if you're overeating, that God would take away my desire for food. No, you'll be in the hospital, okay? Those desires need to be controlled, biblically. But then there are other desires that we have that are particularly ours. I desire wealth and power and privilege, position, prestige, etc. Those are things that need to be destroyed. So we have two general approaches that we're looking at. And it's important to try and understand, you know, where the sources are coming from in our lives. And we'll try and put that into a clearer perspective next week when we talk about mastering desire. But starting point is essentially what, since Lisa used a Catholic term, we would call it data gathering, you know, and developing a problem pattern. It's finding out what are the points that, you know, that are here that show our particular individual's pattern of giving into sin, and what the pattern is, which will teach us about that. I see the hand. I'm going to call on in a minute. So I think right now what I'm going to do is just draw this to a close, and then we'll turn off the recording. We'll have some time for questions or comments.